Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How ready is your garden for a typical Texas summer? This year has been a mild one by North Texas standards, cooler than average temperatures and more rain than we've had in many other years. And yet we all know there are lots more hot, dry seasons in our future. And my guest today has ideas for getting our yards ready now to be sustainably beautiful without a lot of supplemental water through the use of native plants, careful planning, and smart design of sunny and shady areas. Noelle Johnson is a horticulturist who writes for Birds and Blooms magazine, and we're delighted she could be with us. Noelle, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you for having me.
It seems one mistake a lot of us make is getting too comfortable in years like this one, which I don't know if you've been to North Texas recently, but it's cool. It's rather wet compared to what we've been used to. And it makes it seem like we can just plant anything we want and it will do okay. But as it turns out, this might be a good time to establish plants that perform well when conditions are not favorable.
It is. Unfortunately, you know, nice summers like this don't always happen. And yes, and, you know, next summer you could have a very hot, dry summer, little rain, and your garden will suffer. By planting a drought-tolerant garden, you are incorporating native plants that are adapted to the area, and they can handle these periodic weather events that are not normal.
One mistake that I made early on in my life as a homeowner was buying drought-tolerant plants and then thinking, great, they don't need to be watered. But as it turns out, getting them established still takes some water the first year.
It does. And that is, yes, that is a very common mistake. There is a period of time where you have to pay close attention to the watering of new plants because they need to grow their roots. Watering deeply, at least a foot and a half or more for shrubs, allows the roots to grow deeper into the soil. That deeper soil is cooler and it stays moister for longer. So, but to get to that point, you do have to add that water. After a year or so in the ground, once they are more established, they've got that root system that's going to get them through those tougher times without water.
Why are deep roots so important?
Basically, when you have roots, they're very shallow in the soil. And often that does happen because people water shallowly and not deeply. So the roots are going to stay where they are. But toward the surface, the roots are really susceptible to extreme temperatures. Whether it's the heat in the summer, the roots will get awfully hot, or the cold in the winter. In addition, there are natural salts present in the soil, and there's also salts present in a lot of water. And the salts can build up in that root zone if you are watering shallowly, and then that water evaporates out and it leaves those salts behind. Plants don't like a lot of salt around their roots. You'll start noticing signs like the little tips of the leaves turning brown. Deep watering flushes those salts away and really, really keeps your plant a lot healthier. And that deeper soil where those roots are stays moisture longer, like I mentioned before. So periodic periods of drought will not affect your plant as much.
We've all heard the advice, Noelle, about using native plants whenever possible. It can be hard to tell what's a native plant when you go to your average garden center.
Yes. Sometimes those plant labels are very limited as to what they tell you. And the reasons for native plants, they're adapted to your unique climate. They have few insect pests. They're going to look good pretty much whether the weather's great or not. The most important thing to do before you go to a garden center, because that's where we are susceptible to impulse buys. You know, you see that beautiful flowering plant that 4 weeks later will be dead in the ground and you think you did something wrong. Well, it's not you. It just wasn't well adapted for your area. So a little research is very important. And there's two sites I can refer you to. One is wildflower.org. And that's the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower site down in Austin, Texas. And they have a list state by state of native plants and pictures and lots of nice things like that. The other website I would recommend is Texas Smartscape, which has a nice selection of plants for you to take a look at before you buy.
Somewhere else that we can look if we don't have access, it seems like we're always carrying our smartphones, but the leaves of the plants that we're considering putting in can give some good clues as to how drought tolerant they might be.
That's a great point. Leaves have a variety of ways of handling drought situations. One of them are a bunch of tiny leaves, which you'll see in mesquite trees, for example. With shrubs and perennials, you will sometimes see leaves that are more of a grayish green in color. And that grayish green color comes from microscopic little hairs that cover the leaf's surface. And what that does is it helps prevent a lot of water loss through the leaves, which is where plants lose their water.
So fuzzy plants are a good choice.
They sure are.
All right. So what's the best way to get the most out of the water that we do have to use? You mentioned watering deeply and down to a foot and a half. That doesn't mean you put a foot and a half of water into the ground.
Absolutely not. Hose watering is not very efficient because the water tends to run off and it doesn't get very deep. So the best way to water plants is using drip irrigation or a soaker hose. Now, yes, there is some initial expense in setting those systems up, but it uses water so efficiently that you will actually save water and have healthier plants. With drip irrigation, tiny drips of water leave the emitter and they soak deeply into the soil because it takes a little while to get to that point. To get to that depth, that's the big question. How long does it take? Well, it depends on the type of soil you have, and every garden is different. So what I recommend is after you have finished watering, take a long screwdriver or a piece of rebar works really well too, and insert it into the soil where you've just watered. See how far down it goes down. You could push it down fairly easily. And then when you pull it back up, that gives you a pretty good measure of how deeply you have watered and whether you need to add more or less irrigation time.
Like a dirt dipstick.
There you go. Ooh, I like that. Yes.
Okay. So what are good ways? All the soil, as you mentioned, soil can be different even from yard to yard or from neighborhood to neighborhood. How can we know what kind of soil we have and what might be lacking in our own gardens?
Soil testing is a very important thing to do. It tells you what types of soils you have. It tells you what nutrients are present, and more importantly, what nutrients are not. Now, Master Gardener, your local cooperative extension can offer soil testing. There's also soil testing kits you could just buy and do them yourself. So that's an important thing to know. But what another reason in regards to the soil that using native plants are very important, they are adapted to the nutrient levels in your soil. Some soils can be very poor with very little nutrients in large areas, and native plants can handle that a lot better than a non-native.
So if our soil needs some fertilizing and we don't want to use a synthetic fertilizer, what are some good choices?
All right, regardless of the soil you have, whether you have sandy soil, clay, or a mixture of the two, the best thing you could do is amend your soil with compost. And you don't have to be a backyard composter to have access to compost. You can get it at your local nursery quite easily. And incorporating that compost with the existing soil. When adding a plant in the garden, I recommend one part compost to one part native soil mixed together and adding the plant. Compost increases the water-holding capabilities of sandy soils. They also increase the drainage properties of clay soils, and they also have nutrients in them. Other things you can use include aged manures. Cow and chicken manures work very well, and that's a natural source. Blood meal. I know that sounds kind of gross. It is what you think. Blood meal and bone meal are also good natural sources for nitrogen and phosphorus for your garden.
Why does the manure have to be aged?
Manure initially has high amounts of ammonium in it, and that will burn your plants to a crisp. And it's super smelly at that point, too. So manures need to be aged at least 6 months. And that gives them time to a lot of that volatile ammonia evaporates and it becomes more usable. And a lot of the smell goes away as well.
Okay, so many people around here have turf grass, have lawn, and there are, if you try to figure out what is the absolute best type, there are, it seems like there are pros and cons to every kind of grass you can have.
There's no perfect one. Mm-hmm. And the only perfect looking one is artificial grass. And there's a variety of reasons why we may not want to do that. Yes, St. Augustine and Bermuda grass are huge favorites. And they use a lot of water. Bermuda grass is slightly more drought tolerant than the St. Augustine grass. Buffalo grass is a really newer option being considered by lots of people. It's not as showy as Bermuda or St. Augustine, not quite as green, but it is very drought tolerant and does not need to be mowed as often, which is also another advantage. And you see that increasingly being used. In general, buffalo grass can do well with natural rainfall, except in summer. If you want it to stay green, you would give it about an inch of water a week. Other lawns, your St. Augustine and your Bermuda grass, you can do an inch a week. That's going to keep your grass looking okay. And that inch should water your grass to a depth of 6 inches. And again, you can test that using a long screwdriver or that dirt dipstick.
Many people debate how short to cut the grass when it is time to mow.
Yes, and that's a good question, especially you have that neighbor who just has his lawn that looks like it belongs on the green on a golf course.
Right.
And grass, and the best way to have a healthy turf is to let it grow to 3 inches high. And the reason for this is that taller grass will shade the roots. So those roots are a little cooler, and it also helps keep too much water from evaporating. And another side benefit to that is that you'll have fewer weeds bothering your grass.
Listen, I have grass in my yard, but I wonder, is it something that is ultimately unsustainable compared to a lot of other things we might do with our yards?
You know, some people would say get rid of all the grass that you have. There are some varieties being put together now, native grass mixes that can exist pretty much on the natural rainfall. The George W. Bush Presidential Library has a mix of native grasses called Habiturf, and it needs to be watered 4 times a year. And it looks nice, but it's a natural looking grass, kind of a little bit more like a meadow. But that's an option you can do.
And let's talk about mulch, because this is something that is often recommended to gardeners, but people aren't necessarily sure how much to use, what material to use for mulch. What do you recommend?
I'm a big fan of shredded bark for mulch. Mulch ideally should be 3 to 4 inches deep. And what the mulch does is it's a nice blanket for the soil. So it helps protect the soil from getting too hot in the summer and too cold in the winter. It keeps the weeds down. It keeps water from evaporating too quickly. The city of Dallas also offers free mulch in the springtime to residents of the city. One important note about mulch, though, is when you're mulching around plants or, more importantly, trees, you don't want to put the mulch right up against the trunk, because doing that creates this really moist, humid zone where you can have fungal diseases or pests.
Oh, good to know. My guest is horticulturist Noelle Johnson, who writes for Birds and Blooms magazine. We're talking about water-saving gardening ideas, sustainable gardening ideas. If you've got a question or perhaps a suggestion, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with horticulturist Noelle Johnson. She writes for Birds and Blooms magazine, and she's a blogger as well. If you've got a question or would like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. Noelle, do we need to separate out our, say, food plants from our ornamental plants?
Oh, not at all. One of my favorite things to do in the garden is combine my edible plants with my ornamental. An easy way to do this is in your pots. Let's say you buy flowering annuals every spring. A neat thing to do is plant edible plants. You could do herbs such as parsley and basil and sage, and then you could stick in a couple of flowering plants alongside that for a really beautiful look. I like to grow garlic in my pots, and I've got petunias surrounding them, and the foliage of garlic is really quite attractive. And that's another way you can save water. Flowering annuals take a lot of water. But if you put in a variety of herbs instead, whose leaves are very beautiful and ornamental on their own, you would have to use less water to maintain that. Another thing people are doing more often is incorporating edible plants such as leafy greens, you know, leaf lettuces and cabbages and things like that within their home landscape, alongside ornamentals. And sometimes, you know, to the casual observer, you wouldn't even notice that they were edible plants in there. So if you're going to add some supplemental water to your plants, why not have some of those be edible?
And we should probably keep down the number of annuals that we put in.
Yes. Now, some annuals are fine because they do add that splash of color. And I like to think of them as a way to redecorate the outside of your home every year. You could do different color, different plants, different combinations. But it doesn't have to be the solid mass of you know, petunias and pansies. You can definitely lessen that and do smaller amounts. Or, you know, you can toss out those altogether and do drought-tolerant perennials. Drought-tolerant perennials are not ugly, sticky plants. The ones that I like to use are really beautiful and colorful and really just add a huge pop of color to the garden.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Warren in Waco. Hi, Warren.
Hello there.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I had a question. Thoughts on introducing charcoal into the soil of a vegetable garden, and if so, how much?
You know, in general, with vegetable gardening, a mixture of compost, usually 2/3 compost to 1/3 aged manure. I use steer manure. Horse manure works fine. Chicken manure, if you have access to it, works fine. And then incorporating blood and bone meal. And that mixture, especially in a raised bed, does extremely well without worrying about adding any charcoal.
What's the benefit of a raised bed?
What a raised bed does is it takes a lot of work to incorporate soil amendments into the ground itself. And it can be harder to correct any nutrient deficiencies or problems. So a raised bed, which are very easy to make on your own, or they have kits, you know, at your local nursery or big box store, you could build that yourself. But it's a self-contained unit that has real healthy soil that you're not going to have to worry about those nutrient deficiencies that are present in your native soil.
So this is like your little supercharged area to grow whatever it is you really care about. Got it.
Yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Eamon on the line now in Arlington. Hi, Eamon.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I have a mixture of Bermuda grass and St. Augustine in my front yard, and I'd really like one of them to overtake. I don't really mind as to which one does overtake, but I was wondering if there was a way to kind of help one. You know, I've heard Bermuda is an aggressive grass, and it will eventually overtake your yard. So is there a way to make that or the St. Augustine flourish and kind of take over the whole yard?
You know, that's a really good question. Yes, Bermuda grass is native to Africa, and it is. It's extremely aggressive, which is good when you want it in your lawn. It is it will outcompete the St. Augustine right away. Now, St. Augustine requires slightly more water than Bermuda grass and a little more fertilizer. So you could decrease the amount of fertilizer you use slightly, also decrease slightly the amount of water you're giving your lawn. And, you know, your Bermuda grass won't look as good as it normally does, but it will adversely affect the St. Augustine more. So it's probably going to be a little bit of a long haul for you, though, doing that. But if you do that over time, you should see a difference.
One of the things that we do if we're in maybe new construction and we're trying to establish a garden is we want to fill up that empty space, right? And you say a mistake that people sometimes make is not accounting for the fact that if things go well, what you plant today will be much bigger in 3 to 5 years.
Oh, that is a huge mistake that people make. We have throughout the area beautiful flowering shrubs that look fabulous. And a lot of people will plant this little shrub, which is maybe, you know, 1 foot wide and 1 foot tall. And, you know, and then you see all this space around it and you just want to add more in there. Well, the problem comes when that 1 foot by 1 foot shrub starts to grow to its 6 foot by 6 foot mature size and it starts crowding the others. So then the hedge trimmers come out and all that beautiful natural shape of the shrub is stripped away, including the flowers, and you're left with an anonymous green blob in your landscape, which does no good at all. So research plants a little bit. Sometimes it's on the label. See how big they are going to get before you plant them. And, you know, shrubs really, most flowering shrubs grow fairly quickly if they're watered deeply. And yes, just know it's going to look a little sparse for a while. What you could do in the meantime, if that empty space is really bugging you, you know, plant some short-lived perennials in between or some wildflowers or even flowering annuals. Just if you have to fill up that space, go ahead and do it if you're not patient enough to wait till the shrub gets larger.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Scott on the line now in Athens. Hey, Scott.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
I appreciate it.
My wife and I just purchased our very first home, so we're excited about that and trying to do the best we can for not only our yard, but environmentally conscious as well. Question is, I have two young children. What's the best alternative to grass that I can do for my yard situation that's both aesthetically and environmentally pleasing?
Best alternative to grass. Is that right, Scott?
That's correct.
Okay.
Oh, a grass alternative. Well, yes, most people say I've got kids or I've got pets and I want a lawn. And there's a new type of, well, it's not new, but it's come to people's knowledge. It's called frog fruit. And it's a natural ground cover native to Texas, actually. And it looks, you know, it's kind of a nice green carpet. It has little flowers that come out there. It can do well in shade and sun. And, you know, that could be something you can use. Another thing you can do is put in, you know, create a play area. And you could do that with, you know, flagstone steps set into the ground. You could do something. It's a lot of people use broken concrete to create that. It's called urbanite. But it's recycled concrete. And you set it in the ground much like you would flagstone. And what that also does is as it, whenever we do get rain and things like that, it allows the rain to permeate down into that soil and eventually hit the groundwater. You don't set it in concrete, and that works well too. Another great resource for you, there's a fabulous book called Lawn Gone. It's written by a garden writer in Austin, Texas, and she goes in, her name is Pam Pennick, and she goes in and explores all sorts of options as opposed to a lawn. Lots of great pictures and lots of great ways to rethink that thick green carpet outside.
Sometimes I'll open a magazine and I'll see like a flagstone patio and there's moss between the flagstones and it's so beautiful. Is that just not available to me in Texas?
That's kind of tough in Texas, but you can plant thyme, which is an herb with those little tiny leaves. There are many different types of thyme, slightly different colors. And you could plant those in between stepstones. And what's neat is when you step over it, you get that really nice fragrance of thyme. So it's a slightly similar look. It's edible, which is also nice too, but yet moss doesn't really work.
I'll have to try thyme. That's a good idea. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Stuart on the line in Dallas. Hey, Stuart.
Yes, how are you guys doing?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. So I haven't heard the dreaded fairy ring question where you have your circular spot of grass die. I have a mixed St. Augustine front lawn with lots of shade and get these circular patches that I just can't do anything with.
Sometimes those circular patches could be cinch bugs, which can be a real problem, especially with St. Augustine grass. And, you know, it's about diagnosing the problem, and it's lifting up a section of turf and looking under there and seeing, you know, the telltale signs of those little bugs. Nobody wants them in their lawn. The best offense to problems with the grass is a good defense, and that's keeping your grass as healthy as possible. And one of the problems people do is sometimes they over-fertilize and over-water, and believe it or not, that could actually leave their grass open to more pests. So by allowing it to grow to 3 inches tall, that's going to help. Dethatching and aerating your lawn is also important. That's usually done in late spring. Thatch, especially in St. Augustine, can really build up, and that can also impair the health of your grass. If you have cinch bugs, you probably want to get that treated or, you know, not have grass. Sorry.
Well, since you mentioned insects, a problem that I don't think you have too much of in Arizona is mosquitoes at night here. A lot of people would love to be outside, but it's very buggy. We know to leave standing water and get rid of it, but are there plants that drive insects away, or is that just kind of a marketing gimmick?
Well, there are, and you know, we do have mosquitoes here in Phoenix. We get summer rain, and, you know, I don't like mosquitoes, but I know we don't have as many as you do.
I know. I was going to say, oh, come on. maybe you have scorpions, but.
No, we have mosquitoes. We get these torrential rains here in
like that
Arizona.
Monsoon season, yeah.
That monsoon season, we're right in the thick of it, and I've got more mosquitoes that snuck its way into my house than I care to admit. But, okay. Lemongrass is something that can really help with the whole mosquito thing. And it grows in pots, and you can plant pots of that around areas where you congregate. You could do it near your front door. You can do it around the patio. One thing that can really contribute to the mosquito issue are the saucers underneath your pots. I mean, that's prime breeding ground. Hmm. So when possible, if you have large pots of plants outside, don't include a saucer. Just get that off of there, because anytime you go near any area with saucers, you're going to see this cloud of mosquitoes flying around. But try lemongrass.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Rack who says, please comment on man-made grass. I don't have to water except for bushes and trees. I don't have to mow. And I save on gas and exhaust, which pollutes the air.
Yes, artificial turf is very popular. I was recently in Las Vegas, and it's all over there. I mean, residential neighborhoods everywhere. My child's junior high has it, which is kind of surprising. And sometimes they are getting so good at making that you have to get down really close to see whether it's real or not. Artificial turf does get quite hot. So walking barefoot on it in the middle of a summer day can be uncomfortable. But once the sun goes down, it doesn't retain the heat. It dissipates right away. Sometimes people install like a single sprinkler on in the center of it so they can, you know, wash it from time to time. Or if you have animals, that also helps as well. I have mixed feelings about it. My father-in-law had some nice artificial turf installed, and then he got so upset when he would see flowers or leaves on it, he'd bring his vacuum cleaner out and vacuum them off. So in some ways, you're treating one thing for another.
Yeah.
It's environmentally friendly in the way that it's not going to use, you know, water and fertilizers and things. But then you have the production process and the materials it's made out of, which aren't very helpful to the environment. So you just got to pick which one.
What's going on underneath, Noelle? If somebody were to put some out there for a season or two, does the soil beneath that artificial turf, is it affected in some way?
No, actually, not necessarily. There's tiny, tiny holes in the turf, so it allows water to permeate, so you don't have a lot of runoff. And there's usually a base put over the soil of decomposed granite, which is crushed really small, and so it makes a little bit of a bed, and then the artificial turf is placed on top of that. But yes, water does get through there. So long-term, there's not really any effect. If you had it ripped out, it wouldn't be a problem.
Okay, let's go next on the phone now to Sandra in Dallas. Hey, Sandra.
Yeah.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hey, I have a question. I'm from Michigan originally, and I'm used to green lawns. I bought a house in Dallas and have beautiful trees, and the trees have very large roots. And underneath, the soil is almost a clay-like, and I cannot keep any type of grass in the summertime. In the winter I use dry, but in the summer I just have dirt. And I'm wondering is there a type of service I can get to help me diagnose the problem and figure it out? Because I'm at a loss.
Well, the problem is, I'll help you now and I'll save you some money. Warm season grasses don't grow in heavy shade. And so you will see, you know, when you see these landscapes with these gorgeous, beautiful, large, majestic trees and there's just dirt underneath. So what we need to do instead is rethink what we can do with that space. You can do...
Let me jump in. We have to take a break, yeah. And this way we can get the whole list in just a moment. My guest is horticulturist Noelle Johnson. She writes for Birds and Blooms magazine. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Birds and Blooms magazine's horticulturist Noelle Johnson about sustainable gardening ideas. If you'd like to join us, 1-800-933-5372 is the number. And Noelle, you'll remember we heard from Sandra before the break. She said she has big, beautiful trees, but she cannot grow any lawn beneath them. You said time to rethink what goes beneath those trees.
Yes, and I see people fight this battle all the time trying to get the, you know, your warm season Bermuda and St. Augustine. They're just not going to grow under that. It needs sun. So there are some different options. Plant shade-loving perennials underneath instead. Ground covers. You could do liriope or vinca major would provide a nice green ground cover under there, which would thrive in that shady area. In addition, or alternatively, you could also place some step zones into the soil and create a miniature seating area. You could have, you know, little chairs, maybe a little table out there, and draw attention to that instead of, you know, the bare spaces around. But there are quite a few ground covers that will grow in the shade, and that's what I would recommend for her to do.
I had ivy for years under a big magnolia, and it was like Darwinian gardening. I did nothing to it, and it just, you could not kill it.
Yes, and English ivy does great, and it would be beautiful. And you can get the variegated kind to add a little bit of color to the landscape.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Our email address is think@kera.org. Megan in Arlington says, do you have any thoughts on the rampant mutilation of the otherwise gorgeous crepe myrtles in our area? She's asking about, you know, there are people here who take crepe myrtle and really prune the heck out of them every year.
I've seen that. And here in Arizona, it's done to Texas sage shrubs.
Huh.
We call it poodle pruning because they resemble a poodle. And we have to get past our thought process of flowering shrubs and trees as we strip all character away from that, you know, and instead of a garden filled with beautiful, naturally shaped plants that have flowers, like I said earlier, anonymous green blobs, it does nothing for the landscape. And in addition, that type of pruning is extremely stressful for plants. Anytime you prune, excessively prune a plant, they are constantly regrowing the leaves that they lost, because leaves are how plants make food. And because they're having to grow over and over a new set of leaves, they use more water to do that. After a while, shrubs get kind of tired. Trees will get tired of doing that. And they will be shorter lived. They can develop large dead areas as well. It's really time to educate. And maybe that's by you having your own garden filled with plants that you allow to grow the way nature intended them to.
So do we need to prune crepe myrtle at all?
Yes. Plants should be pruned, but not multiple times and not to achieve an unnatural looking shape. Not at all.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Scott is on the line now in McKinney. Hey, Scott.
Hi. We erected a kind of structure over our front door, and we want to have climbing ornamental fragrant roses. And last summer, we developed rose rosette disease on these roses, and we ripped them out. We planted some new ones there this year, and those too developed rose rosette disease, which I understand now is basically contaminated the soil, and so you really can't plant roses there anymore. And so we're looking for some kind of alternative that would be, obviously not, probably nothing is going to be as beautiful as a climbing rose, but something you'd recommend that'd be fragrant and very beautiful and something that could climb up this trellis.
Sounds like such a nice idea.
It does. It really does. And, you know, wherever you are, when you see a climbing rose trailing up over an arbor, you kind of stop in your tracks and admire the beauty. You may want to try coral honeysuckle. You've got that beautiful fragrance. You've got the tubular flowers. It leafs out early in the season, and it lasts until frost. And there are orange, red, and yellow varieties. So I would try some honeysuckle.
And that honeysuckle doesn't have to be replanted every year, right? It just dies off and then comes back in the spring.
Yes, it does. It's hardy to zone 4, so it'll do fine in Dallas.
Great. Let's go next on the phone to Mary in Dallas. Hey, Mary.
Hi. I collect water and rain buckets, and I'm having a major problem with mosquito larvae. And I was wondering the best way to either keep them out or kill them.
You know, that's a tough problem. You have to keep them tightly sealed. That's the key to keeping the mosquitoes out of there. Also, finding a way to use that water fairly quickly really is the only way to make sure that the mosquitoes aren't going to be a problem. If you want to plant lemon balm nearby, that might help out, but it's the tight seal that's the most important thing to keep those mosquitoes from becoming an issue.
Let's go next to Sunny in Plano. Hello, Sunny.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question on a weed that's in our flowering beds. We bought a house and we have mature nuts edge grass in there, and we've tried redoing the whole bed, but they keep coming back and with gumption. Is there any way that we can get rid of these, any natural way, or what do you suggest?
Nuts edge is such a frustrating weed, and I've had my own bad experiences with it invading areas of my grass. And the problem with nuts edge is when you pull it, if you leave a little bit of root behind, it's going to grow a new one, and it just seems to spread. It is tough to get rid of. It really is, unless you have your turf cut out or that area cut out, other than manually pulling it up. There is a weed killer I like to use that's natural. And all it takes is something you've got at home. It takes white vinegar and it takes dish soap. And if you mix a gallon of white vinegar with 1 ounce of dish soap and then you put it in a spray bottle, that will get rid of most weeds. But really tough weeds, it doesn't. So what you would do in the case of nutsedge is you could get a white vinegar. Normal white vinegar has 5% acetic acid in it, but there are white vinegars you can get that have a higher amount, such as 10%. Now, it is non-selective, which means that it'll kill anything it touches, but you can use that to kind of help with this problem. It is natural, not as effective as the synthetic stuff. Another way to really get rid of nutsedge where it I've done from time to time after a heavy rainfall, it is pretty easy to pull them up by hand. But unfortunately, there's some real strong chemicals that are specific for nutsedge. But if you want to stay away from that, it's pulling and trying the strong vinegar and just soap.
But then once the vinegar and soap is washed away, we could put something new in that space and it would be able to grow okay.
Absolutely. Okay. Yes.
All right. Let's go next on the phone to Krishna in Dallas. Hey, Krishna.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I have 12 to 15 foot magnolia tree outside, and it somehow, I just bought this house, and it has a big poison ivy, like, going around the tree all the way up to the top.
Oh, no.
So I'm trying to see how I would like to save it, and then I want to see how safely I can remove it, and if you have any suggestions how I can, that'd be helpful.
Wow. That's challenging. All right, so you want to get rid of the poison ivy?
Yes.
Okay, from the tree. All right. Well, especially if you want to get it unwrapped and get up there and take care of that, you may want to talk to a certified arborist who can get up there and has the tools available to get up in the tree and tear it down, but you have to kill it at the roots. So, and there's any number of things that you can do to help get rid of that. With chemicals, which we don't like to use. But sometimes it's too just digging it out. And then just anytime you see little new ones growing up, you got to pull it out. But you may want to get an arborist to get up there and get into your tree to get it all down.
Okay, I have a question for you. This is a personal question. I have a fig tree in my backyard, and I would really like to harvest some figs in a month or two, but I don't think there will be anything left after the squirrels eat all the ones that are not even ripe yet. Any way to keep them away without...
Oh, that's frustrating.
It is. I'm so excited, but I don't know if I'll ever taste one.
You know, squirrels can be really tough. You know, I don't know so much about squirrels, but with birds, you can tie CDs, literally CDs, with the little shininess. I know that keeps birds away. Little strips of foil can work. Also, you may try bird netting, and you can get that at your local nursery. The case with bird netting, though, you have to be very careful about, is you want to gather it at the bottom so that there's no holes. If you have a hole, a little bird can get stuck in there, or a squirrel, but that might help.
So with the netting, you would just basically drape the whole thing and then tie it off, and hopefully they can't get quite as easily to the fruit.
Yes, and that bird netting is really helpful with any type of fruit tree you have when you want to keep the birds away from, and hopefully squirrels too.
You have written some really interesting stuff about succulents, which I think of as very exotic, but it turns out they're not so hard to keep alive, and they're not even so hard to start from a cutting.
Oh, they're easy to start. There's types of columnar cactus that do very well from cutting. So if you have, you know, a multi-armed cactus, you can take a cutting, meaning that you cut it, and then you take it and you rest it in a shady, dry area for 2 weeks in order to allow the end to callus over. You want it to kind of dry. And then you can go ahead and replant it in the landscape. And believe it or not, it'll grow in most cases. You can't cut it and plant it right away, because if you did that, it would probably rot. That's why you have to have that two-week period. There's types of agave century plants that produce little babies, and you can take those babies off and stick them in the ground somewhere else and grow those too. But succulents are a fabulous way to landscape, drought tolerant, but they're also beautiful, and succulents also do really well in pots. So you can ditch the flowering annuals if you want to all the way and just go with succulents, and edible things in your pots.
And can a succulent make it through the winter, a winter that we have here in North Texas?
Absolutely. I'll mention a few of my favorites. Agave, like I said, are my favorites. There's one called Whale's Tongue Agave, which is this beautiful light gray color. Absolutely gorgeous, and the leaves look like a whale's tongue. An artichoke agave is another one of my favorite, and it's a small blue-gray agave that looks like an artichoke. And there's a third one. It's called Victoria Agave, and it's just this beautiful, smaller, dark green with these white margins, which are just stunning to look at. Desert Spoon Sotal is another really popular one. And then my next two are Silver Spurge, which has these really funky-looking gray stems and chartreuse flowers in spring. And then Red Yucca. Red Yucca, it's not a yucca. I don't know why they call it that, but it is a great plant. It looks like an ornamental grass, but it has gorgeous coral-colored blooms in late spring. It's just stunning.
So I have to ask you this, since you write for a publication called Birds and Blooms, what are the best ways to make a bird-friendly yard?
Oh, bird-friendly yard. You want to provide areas for shelter. You know, that could be trees or tall shrubs. Provide nesting materials. I like to use those little, they have these little cages where you can put bird food inside. Sometimes you could put in things inside in the spring before nesting season. You could put in things like yarn and hair and little bits of fluff, and they'll flock to that. In the case of hummingbirds, I mean, everyone wants to see hummingbirds visit their garden, and you want to, the best way to attract them is flowering plants that usually have tubular flowers. They're usually attracted to those. Red and orange are their favorite colors, but oranges and pinks too, and purples. I have a yellow Esperanza shrub, which my hummingbirds go crazy for. That works as well. Bird feeders, yes, you can put those out in your garden, but you don't have to in order to attract birds. They like plants that produce seeds that they can also take. And places for perching are also really important for a bird-friendly garden.
Excellent advice. Noelle Johnson is a horticulturist who writes for Birds and Blooms magazine. You can also find her blog online. Noelle, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.